My name is Steve Westgarth, and this is The Engineering Leader. Today on The Engineering Leader, it's a pleasure to be joined by Usman Hamid. Usman is the Vice President of Enterprise Architecture and Engineering at GSK Consumer Healthcare, the consumer healthcare company that I work for, which is due to become Haleon, a standalone healthcare company, later this month in July. Usman also has the very great pleasure of being my boss, which means that today we're effectively going to take my one-on-ones public, which is just a little bit worrying, if I'm honest with you. But Usman, it's a pleasure to have you on The Engineering Leader today.
No, thank you for having me on, Steve.
And, you know, so Usman and I in person today, it's the first time we've done an Engineering Leader in person, and we've done this because we've actually both been out in India this week. So we've been doing some stuff with our leadership teams and our colleagues in India. You're really kind of connecting on the ground. It's been a really, really amazing week, right?
It has. It's just been absolutely fantastic to be out in Bangalore in India to meet our teams. So we've built capability out here over the past 6 to 7 months since you've joined, and actually putting, you know, faces to names that we've seen on Teams, meeting people, bonding, talking about our culture. It's just been fascinating to be out here.
It's really interesting because, I mean, we're in a world that is becoming, you know, ever more global, right? And, you know, you think about Haleon, you know, the largest consumer healthcare company in the world on day one when we launch. And, you know, we do have colleagues in lots of different geographies. And, you know, as much as Teams has enabled us to connect, you know, much better over pandemic, it doesn't beat actually being together in person and doing that social thing, right?
No, and I think that's what I really enjoyed this week, just, you know, getting to know the team a lot better, understanding what kind of drives them, what motivates them, looking at how they interact, facial expressions, reading their body language. I think there's a lot of benefit that flexible working has brought to companies around the world. But, you know, there's a time and a place for human interaction, as I would call it. And I think this week has been extremely valuable. And I think we leave here understanding our people a lot better. And it helps us become better leaders as a result of that.
Yeah, no, totally agree with you. And I think as well, I mean, it's really palpable on the ground how much, you know, the team members actually appreciate the fact that we've come out. And, you know, we've been talking about actually it needs to be both ways. So this is not just about us coming out here regularly. We also need to find opportunities to bring our Indian colleagues to the UK and also to the US, right?
Indeed, yeah. And we've got to figure out how we do that cross-pollination and we make people feel inclusive and part of a global team, so they're not just seen as people that just work in India, for example. And we've got to figure out organisationally how we do that. But I think one thing that this week has kind of, you know, left with me as a kind of a thing in my mind is that we need to figure out a way to, you know, drive that cross mobility within the organisation, because it helps develop our people, and that's the most important thing for me.
Definitely. And I mean, we were talking last night at dinner about sort of diverse teams. And actually, you know, if you look across our leadership team, it's, you know, it's incredibly diverse. You know, we've got people from all sorts of cultures, all sorts of different backgrounds. How important do you think it is to really bring diversity of thought into any team that you build?
Look, I've built a lot of teams in my career. Some well, some bad. Obviously, you don't get everything right. I'm quite happy to say that. But I think what I've learned over my time is having different perspectives is massively important. And, you know, ultimately, the success of your team is driven by the individuals that you have underneath, you know, working for you. And it's to use like an analogy from my, you know, I'm a big fan of music, but there's an old saying that the band is only as good as the drummer. Type of thing. And, you know, all of you are kind of like my like backing band, if you want to call it. But without you being effective, you know, I can't be effective. So I look for, you know, complementary skills. And I think, you know, in my head, when I hire people, I always think about how they're going to fit together. What are the personality types? We talked a lot about building team roles, and that's a big part of my kind of thinking around how we build high performing teams. And yeah, it's one way to attack the puzzle. There's no real art really, or you know, in terms of how you do it. Sometimes things happen by chance, as I did with meeting you, and things start to fall into place. But yeah, I do want to build. I always want to build and have it in mind to build diverse teams. And we talked about last night actually that, you know, from our team perspective, you know, you are the only, I guess, male white individual right now, yeah. which is fascinating because it wasn't a conscious decision to actually do that, to be fair. It just happens to happen. It's happened that way organically. Doesn't really mean anything, but the optics around it might look quite strange to people, but yeah, it's pretty cool the way it's worked out.
It is, that's 100%. And I mean, I think I've said before, I mean, you know, I've come and, you know, we've started to form an engineering team here, and actually, you know, the male to female ratio in engineering is close to 50-50.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, that's phenomenal. I mean, actually, I would love to, you know, to kind of build on that, actually maybe go slightly the other way. But a lot of organisations, you know, really struggle to get female engineers to kind of, you know, to want to participate and be involved in tech. So I think we've been really fortunate here to have the opportunity to kind of to do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of my team are getting involved with, you know, things like Girls Who Code and those sorts of things. And I think we really need to build on that and kind of use that as a platform, because, you know, half the battle is actually having people in your own image in the team who actually you can associate with and say, hey, you know what, this company's, you're really willing to support you no matter which, you know, what background you're from, or what personal characteristics you might have.
Yeah, we've talked about how, you know, day one, Helion will be, it's a new brand, it's a new name. It's going to be something that's new to, you know, people who are looking for jobs. So it's important that we get our brand out there, you know, through these forums like Girls Who Code, etc., and, you know, other industry forums where we can talk about the work we're doing in engineering. That's going to be one way to attract talent, really. But, you know, for me, it's always been something that if you just live and breathe it, then it just becomes part of your natural thinking. You see a lot of people and companies out there who have this kind of outward marketing PR about being diverse and really focusing on diversity. I think we just do it naturally. So we don't really have to promote it as, you know, we are the best or whatever. It's ingrained within our culture, our way of thinking. And, you know, we it just happens for us naturally. And I think that's when I know it's working really, really well, that we're not trying to hit quotas or we're not, you know, trying to check boxes. It's just we always go where the talent is, and we do it on that basis, knowing that we have to be inclusive. And it's working for us right now, as it's showing within the team.
Absolutely. So let's talk about more about your role. Let's talk about enterprise architecture in particular.
Okay.
So we haven't really talked a lot about architecture on the Engineering Leader. We spoke to Amar Meehan,
who works at Boost,
which was a great podcast a few weeks ago. But that was very much about solution architecture. And I guess the space that you occupy is enterprise architecture. So I mean, maybe for folks that haven't really understood enterprise architecture before, or maybe haven't, you know, been involved in that space, maybe just tell us a little bit about what enterprise architecture is.
Yeah, it's a really good question, actually. And the simple analogy that I use is kind of like the construction analogy. So, you know, an enterprise architect is in effect a city planner. So, you know, they are looking at the blueprint for a city, how many buildings we might need, what types of buildings we might need. And then where Amar comes into the conversation is like he is looking at, you know, how you would build a house, for example. And then your technical architects, which is another kind of, you know, role within architecture, is looking at, well, how many bricks do I need? It's like your quantity surveyor, basically. Each architect is there to play a very specific role. And they all bring different skills to an organization, really. So that's where enterprise architecture kind of adds value, is that they are looking at, I guess, the capabilities that your organization really needs, and they're working more at a business level. So high business focus, not so much a technology focus. Whereas in Amar's, he's trying to get a blend of both, basically, and your technical architects go the other way. And it's an important role because without having a blueprint for your organization, understanding what capabilities you need to build and how they're going to differentiate you from your competition, you actually can't translate that into technical solutions later down the line. So it kind of acts as a great map for you in terms of where you want to go, where you want to invest. And everyone thinks they're an enterprise architect. And I think we've come across that. But I think, you know, an enterprise architect, you know, the clue's in the name, really. You have to think enterprise-wide, not just from a product perspective. It's a misunderstood role as well, because a lot of people think it's about power. A lot of people think it's about, you know, centralizing decision-making. It's not really. It's just somebody who's clever enough and can understand business problems and figure out a way to articulate that in a language that makes sense for people at different levels of the organization.
And I think the idea of levels is really important, because effectively what you talk about here is levels of detail.
Exactly.
You know, if you think about something like Google Earth, you can zoom out and you see the world, you then zoom into a continent or into a country or into a city. And as you go to a more granular level of detail, you need different skill sets.
That's a fantastic way to describe it. It really is. And I think I can't do a better job than that. I think if people get that kind of concept that you just talked about, you know, the EA is really the actual global view. We are trying to represent Earth in a technical organizational context, really.
And one of the challenges, I mean, if you think about your large corporate organizations today, they're really complex machines. Yeah. They've got, you know, an awful lot going on. And, you know, purely by the way that, you know, we structure or we fund things, you know, it does tend to lead us to siloed kind of thinking and to create organizational silos. I mean, historically, you've got the IT department, the marketing department, the business that might be, you know, kind of trying to drive specific propositions or outcomes.
Yeah.
You know, it's all kind of done in isolation. And then actually this, you know, cross-functional thinking is a really difficult thing to drive. So when you're thinking about enterprise architecture and you're trying to think cross-business, how do you get the business to care? Because actually they're trying to drive their own specific outcomes in their own specific area.
Yes, look, it's a problem that is a common problem for pretty much every organization, right? People who work within towers have, you know, think they have a certain level of autonomy, you know, driven primarily by having a budget and having ownership of that budget to drive the outcomes that they want. But then we end up making sometimes very isolated decisions on what we need. And then there's impacts downstream, further down the line, where we have duplication of, you know, capabilities, for example. So like the enterprise architects really, you know, need to be interacting at a kind of a, you know, we talked about different levels, but they're looking at it from a capability level that's going to be beneficial for the entire organization. And, you know, they're trying to look, pardon the word, enterprise wide to see, well, is the solution that's being built in one product area, has it got the potential to be, you know, applicable in one or two areas? And that's that enterprise wide thinking, where we're trying to reduce the duplication of technology. We're thinking about commerciality, and we're thinking about how we, as custodians of the money of our organization, are spending that in the most effective way possible. And it comes from trust as well, really, because there is a reluctance for people to engage, to your point, because they think an individual is going to come in and they're going to, you know, take away my decision rights or whatever. It's not. It's about helping them think more laterally about the choices that they're making in the context of the broader organization. And, you know, sometimes you do have to do things that are specific for a particular like solution, but you're doing it with the right kind of thinking and approach and process and the right governance controls as well to make that decision, so it's more informed. So the actual interlock between the EAs and the business is, you know, if it's not happening, then I guess you will suffer overall, because you'll make isolated point in time like choices, really. So it's an ever evolving organizational kind of the dynamic that you have to kind of do. So yeah, so there's no right or wrong answer, there's no real formula, but it's about just being visible, being involved in as many conversations as possible, and building trust as somebody who's going to enable someone rather than stop them from being, you know, stopping their progress, basically.
And if we think about it in the sense of organizational capability, I think it's a really easy way to articulate some of the benefits. Yeah. So if you think about, you know, an organization, in fact, any organization, maybe you want to take payments. So payments might be a capability. Yeah. Now, if we're going to build a proposition or a solution in one area of the business that needs to take payments, you can totally see that it makes sense to use that same payment capability in a different part of the organization, because you don't want to have two contracts with two different payment providers, which clearly duplicates cost. Yeah. You know, when actually you can leverage that same capability, that same cost base, you know, to serve two areas of the organization. So if you put a cost lens on it, you know, you can totally see how organizations can save money by doing this. And that's obviously very important. But are there other benefits other than just financial saving?
Yeah, there is. And look, I think, you know, one of the big things is around, and we talked about it, is once you have a centralized capability, such as payments, for example, in the context of this conversation, then actually you can start to mobilize more innovation and thinking into that product area, and thinking across like how can I use different use cases to add to that product roadmap. Basically, you can start to empower teams then and build capability in that space without duplicating that elsewhere in other areas and working in silos, to our point. So there's definitely commercial benefits, not just from a saving from a tech and a platform perspective, but you're also, you know, you have to hire people. Mm. And you have to bring the right skills in, really. And, you know, one of the things that I believe passionately about is, you know, talent mobility is key actually. Mm. And, you know, if somebody just works in one part of the organization and can't see a future, then they'll kind of go. So having this kind of view of, we're going to create a centralized capability which can be leveraged, it's got technical benefits because you're using a single tech stack. It's got commercial benefits. People feel involved. You can have a product roadmap, and you can plug and play that capability into a number of different propositions, which then speaks to this concept of being agile, because you're being quick and you're not having to reinvent the wheel every time. And how you do PCI compliance, for example, or how you handle people's personal data, it's all been thought of, and you've encapsulated it in that product, and it allows the business to be faster and more nimble and getting their digital propositions out. Otherwise, you're back to the drawing board every time trying to figure out how to do payments.
The underlying thing for that for me is all about complexity. And, you know, I think mentioned before, your organizations like ours, your big, large corporate organizations, they're complex by nature. Yeah. Because of the way they're set up, the way they're structured, what we're trying to do. You know, we're working in, you know, tens of markets around the world. You know, it's going to be naturally complex. And actually, you know, for me, what I think it's about is removing complexity from the organization where you can. And if you're in a world where you have, you know, people who are making independent decisions who aren't necessarily aligned up to that enterprise strategy, you know, maybe in one area of the business you've decided to use .NET, and in another area of the business, you know, they prefer to use MERN, probably because of the people that we're able to bring in. But actually, that then means you're maintaining two different sets of services. You've got two different tech stacks in the organization. You haven't got that interoperability. From that talent retention point of view, you mentioned, you know, the people mobility point.
Yeah.
You know, you can't necessarily rotate engineers to where the demand is and to where you need them to work.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not saying that your technology doesn't move on. I'm not saying that just because you're using this particular tech stack now that you're never going to evolve the tech stack, and you're not going to bring in new things. But I think it's really important to do that in an intentional way so that you don't introduce unnecessary complexity. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
No, I agree. And, you know, I think unknowingly you can be contributing to your organization's technical debt without even knowing it by having that kind of scattergun approach to making technology choices. And I think, you know, ultimately, whatever you decide to do, whatever language you choose to build it, you know, do one thing well. So it's kind of being master of one thing instead of jack of all trades, basically. Yeah. And I think that allows you to identify the talent that you need so you can build your organizational capability from a people perspective and invest in it. Otherwise, you're having to figure out how you kind of mash all this stuff together, and then you can't give people that mobility that you want without having to upskill or retrain them. I think for me, there's huge benefits in having that kind of very kind of focused view on what we build in, how do we build it in the right way, what do you want to standardize on, and that kind of speaks to standards, principles, and patterns. For example, having a consistent way to do things, again driving agility into the organization in terms of how we move fast. Without doing that, I think you set yourselves up for a lot of difficult challenges further on down the road without having a very clear view from the outset what you want to achieve. And if you look at the major global tech companies, they have this strategy as well, really. And that's why a lot of people want to work for them as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you mentioned their standards, principles, patterns. Now, I mean, that's something that we talk about a lot in our world, but it's sometimes quite difficult to quantify and understand. So, I mean, if you think about an enterprise architecture pattern or an architectural pattern you might want to adopt for the organization, you know, give us an example of what one of those sort of patterns might be and how you might use it.
Good question. And again, it goes back to my point of not having to reinvent the wheel every time again. When we get involved in projects or building something new, we have to understand, I guess, first of all, what the problem is. And in terms of the three roles that we identified, you've got architects who are laying out the strategy or the blueprint. You've got your technical architects, who are effectively your builders or your product experts, and then your solution architects, to like Amar, who came on the podcast a few weeks ago, who are trying to understand, well, how do I translate what the business wants into a technical design for the organization? Now, if we want to build an application that requires event streaming, for example, then it makes sense for us to have a consistent way to be able to do that. And that is what we classify as a pattern or a building block, where we've approved a standard for the organization in how we do event streaming. It could be Kafka, it could be anything, but just having a very clear view, a very clear diagram about, hey, we're going to do event streaming in this way, that then allows the solution architects to go, oh, event streaming, I've got that, I'll take it off the shelf and I'll put it into my design. It's been pre-approved, it's gone through all the right rigor in terms of security assessments and testing, etc. And it means that we don't have to spend a lot of time and effort in reinventing the wheel about how we do event streaming. And that is the concept of a standard and a pattern, basically, where we approve something as a standard. This is event streaming, this is how we do it. And the pattern in itself is the architectural pattern about how we make that a reality, or how we build it, for example. And that is where you can start to define your deployments as code. And if there is a code, if there's a piece of Terraform that exists for how you deploy event streaming, then you don't have to do that. It's been done for you. And again, you have a consistent way to do that. And no matter what digital proposition that you build, we're doing event streaming in the same way. We're not adding to technical debt. We're not adding to complexity, to your point. We're not adding to increased licensing costs for having different vendors doing the same thing. And we're building capability then in a particular area that we can just reuse and leverage time and time again, because we're keeping the knowledge quite you know, focused on a single solution.
It plays to organizational agility as well, because I think that one of the things that I've observed in my career, in virtually every organization I've worked in, we want to achieve outcomes for our business fast. Yeah. The business need to, to achieve, what it needs to do in the shortest possible time in order to achieve its growth case or its business case.
Yeah.
Or the reason that we're doing things. We all have that challenge. Now, if you're reinventing things from scratch every time you run your program or a project, then, obviously it's going to take longer. It makes sense. Yeah. Whereas to your point about the building blocks, if you think about this as Lego, you can kind of take those bits of Lego, put them together in a new way in order to meet a particular outcome or a particular use case. And that's naturally going to be faster than having to understand everything that's inside the box from scratch every time you do it. And just play into that organizational silo point of view, what I guess you're trying to do by having that cross-functional capability is to supercharge that. Because even if individual silos or individual parts of the organization are thinking about how they might have building blocks inside their own area, what you're trying to do is to say, let's supercharge this. Let's make that work across the enterprise, so that we're all kind of working in a similar way into a similar standard.
Exactly. And without doing that, like, the business will get frustrated because things just take too long, like you said. So, and I guess this is the difference between people who work at a solution level, at kind of a product level, and then the enterprise level, is that, we are trying to build things that can be reused multiple times because we understand the benefits that it brings, really. And that's the conversation that we're having at that business level around agility and how we can get quicker, to kind of market. Without doing that, as I mentioned before, it just becomes hugely problematic to deliver at speed, because we're having to reinvent the wheel, trying to solve problems that we've already solved time and time again.
And I think the other thing for me is, we talk a lot about centralized versus decentralized. And for me, this is not a one-size-fits-all. Or we're not talking about saying, hey, everything has to be done at the center, or everything has to be federated. What you're actually saying is, let's get the patterns, get the principles, get the standards, get them defined and make that work. But then you can actually allow some federation, where people can use those standards, those building blocks, and actually start integrating their own solution. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you've got to have your one team at the center that's doing everything. And actually, really, what you really want to do is to centralize the capability so that you can start. You're looking after people management, retention, progression, all of those things. You can look after the how we do something, but actually, the teams still work directly for the business, right? You know, and actually, I think that horizontal thinking, where you're aligning people to actually, from a task management point of view, you're still work for the people who know what the business actually needs and a best place to do that. You know, that's still really important, right? It's just structuring yourself in a slightly different way to allow you to leverage those additional benefits that we're talking about.
Yeah, look, you know, patterns, you know, won't stay static. Right. So like by centralizing everything, then you're kind of forcing the people within that central function to kind of evolve and iterate that over time. But, you know, we've talked about the benefits of things like inner sourcing, for example.
Absolutely.
And, you know, you can talk about that in a sense of doing that with code and like libraries and APIs. But it also applies to architectural patterns as well, where if you define something as a standard and then you allow that federated model to use that. On the ground, as things evolve and we mature and we find ways to optimize it, you can get the community to contribute and feedback to say, hey, we've refined this part of the pattern and we've optimized it. So we think we should review that and make it a standard. So you're creating a continuous feedback loop through that innovation process where everyone is contributing to it. So it's not just on a single central function to come up with the thinking, because you can't do that. You're not going to be successful. So you're trying to tap into the talent for the entire organization and making sure that you're getting the best out of everyone, because they will have the specific knowledge within their product areas that's going to be beneficial. And you can take a look at that objectively and then, you know, make it enterprise-wide.
I mean, let's just actually touch on inner source for a little while, because listeners may not have come across that before. So, you know, many people will have heard of open source.
Yeah.
You know, and many people may have contributed to open source projects. And, you know, what you tend to find is you have a maintainer team who are looking after the main product itself. And then, you know, the wider engineering community takes a code branch, you know, makes a feature, and then you know, submits a pull request back into the maintainer team. And what we're trying to do within the source is to operate that same model, right? So we're trying to say, you know, we've got lots of code repositories. We know we can't do everything centrally in one team. So hey, if you need a feature, rather than putting it into our backlog and doing it, why don't you actually go and develop the feature? And then just raise a PR back to me, and I'll check that it meets my standards, principles, patterns, check that it aligns with kind of what we're trying to do, and then I'll merge it back in, so that you've then taken more control into your team, in order to allow you to accelerate and to become more agile. Is that a concept? I mean, I guess we're at the very start of our journey here at Haleon in terms of how that works.
Yeah.
We've both been quite excited about the concept, but I mean, do you really think it could work in an enterprise like ours?
I think it can, really. And I think, you know, it goes back to a very starting point of this podcast around diversity, right? Mm-hmm. So if you've got just one team who has to do all the thinking on a particular product, then you're going to be limited by the knowledge within that team, basically, right? Once you kind of decide to open source that, then you've got an entire community of like developers and people who use that library who may think of other things that we might have missed, for example. So what you get is a benefit of contribution to your product roadmap for things that you might not even thought of, or use cases that you might have thought of. So like, why would you stop that innovation? It doesn't make any sense. So we have to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, right? But, you know, and what I mean by that is, yes, we can create something, but then we expose it out to the world and it's open for critique and for code review, etc. That's kind of an accepted thing, you know, for like developers to kind of come across. But there's a lot of like benefits from having that kind of mindset of, hey, we're gonna create something, but we're gonna make it community wide, and therefore we actually invite contributions from people. And then you get the benefits of their expertise from their viewpoint, and then you build that into your product roadmap. And ultimately, you have the overall say whether, you know, that code fits within, you know, the right guardrails for your particular product. So you're still the actual decision maker, but you're inviting ideas. And obviously, we're talking about right now doing that from an internal perspective. So we're looking to externalize it internally. But in the future, you can see where that's got benefits by externalizing it to people outside of your core organization. And there's a lot of companies that do that really, really well as well. And that's the aim, really. So, you know, that's where I think it's got a lot of benefits. And I think that's the kind of the culture that we're trying to drive, is that kind of culture of openness and contribution, because that's how the community works. And I think that's how you get the best out of the community that we've got.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, it's kind of a different mindset for organisations, right? Because I mean, historically, your organisations would have been very concerned about their IP. And actually, you know, if you've got code, we actually want to squirrel it away and kind of keep it to ourselves and not really share it. But moving to this mindset where actually, you know, I've got services. Other organisations might have benefit by using those services. I might even, as an organisation, be able to commercialise some of those APIs and some of those services. And if you've exposed those APIs publicly anyway, you know, why wouldn't you expose the code that kind of sits behind it? Because if somebody externally has a use case for using your API and you're happy to support that, they can contribute, right, and actually help to build your organisation's value. But that's a very, very different mindset to, you know, maybe, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, when organizations want to, you know, keep control of everything that they're doing themselves.
Yeah, I think we've seen a lot of good examples of, you know, people and companies externally doing that. You know, the examples of industries, you know, healthcare in general with the NHS have started to move into that direction. We've seen like the rail industry adopting that kind of mindset with the train timetables. Like, imagine every product's having to reinvent the wheel about how they do that and things like that. It just wouldn't, you know, we just wouldn't have the diverse like nature of applications that we have on the app stores right now without doing that. So we're on the start of our journey, and we're trying to embed that in here at kind of Haleon. And I think it's going to be interesting to see how that kind of progresses over time. But I think we understand the actual benefits. It's just about changing the mindset of people within the organisations to make them feel comfortable that they can contribute, and we want them to contribute overall because we want their input.
And I mean, it's also a journey, I think, that, you know, lots of other organisations need to go on. I mean, I don't really want to politicise the podcast, but, you know, there was an announcement by the health secretary a few weeks ago, about, you know, the intention for centralising lots of healthcare data, you know, under the remit of one particular organisation. And, you know, kind of taking a step back and kind of looking at that and thinking about what that actually means, that really worries me and concerns me, that actually you're putting all of that control into one organisation. Whereas actually kind of embracing this idea and getting comfortable with being uncomfortable with your data being federated, and, you know, it kind of gives you the ability to really kind of push the power into the user's hands and let the user control what they're consenting for the organization to do with their data. And I think, you know, consumers generally they're intelligent, right? You know, and if you can say to a consumer, hey, if you give me consent to do X, Y, or Z, and this is the benefit that you get, if the consumer can really see a benefit to that, they're going to say yes.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think it's where you have organizations that, you know, actually kind of trying to do that slightly underhand and kind of, you know, trying to share data for a reason that, you know, maybe, you know, it monetizes something for them. It doesn't actually give any value to the consumer. I think that's where you have real problems.
Yeah, I think the key word there is value. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, if you consent to your data being used, but it ultimately gives you value or improves something that is a problem for you, then 100% you'll give it, you know, you'll kind of give your consent. I think it's when it's not clear that what value you're going to get is where you might be a bit reluctant and say no, really. And I think a lot of companies have tried this like centralization thing like in the past, and there's varying degrees of success out there. And, you know, we'll keep a watchful eye on to see how that kind of progresses, really, and how that kind of evolves. But I think in terms of the culture that we want to build here, I think we're very clear in our direction that, you know, we believe this type of model is going to get the best out of the community that we have in here and create that kind of, you know, that software engineering guild where we can, you know, talk about best practice and like knowledge sharing. Like we want to promote inclusivity within engineering, and this is one way to make sure that every developer who works here, whether in data engineering or whether in DevSecOps or whether in MERN or whatever, has got a way to contribute to something. So let's try it and let's see what kind of improvements it brings to us going forward.
Now, you touched a little bit there on culture, and it's one of the things we've been doing while we've been out here in India, and we had a really good session with our leadership talking around, you know, what culture we want to create and being really deliberate with creating that culture. And I think that, you know, culture is something which you do need to be deliberate about, right? It's something which, you know, both comes top down and also bottom up.
Yeah.
You know, it's important for everyone to be involved in defining that culture, but it's also to be really clear about, you know, what values we expect and how we expect people to behave.
Yeah.
How do you really go about, you know, building an effective culture that people really want to kind of be a part of and align to?
Yeah, look, we purposefully spent a long time this week thinking about our culture and thinking about how we want to not just work as a leadership team, but then also how we start to distill that messaging down to people and levels below. So we're all singing from the same hymn sheet, to kind of use that phrase. I think the way that we've approached it here is initially through trying to really understand what we mean by culture and starting to define behaviors that we think resonate with us as individuals and as a leadership team. Like, you know, I think there's common things like, yes, we want to treat other people with respect and, you know, things like that. But we've also got into some really difficult, you know, cultural aspects, which is, you know, we want to hire fully formed adults, for example, was a phrase that was used. And, you know, that might seem quite harsh to the listeners on the actual podcast, but what we're actually saying that is that we want to hire people who have got a certain level of IQ and intelligence where, you know, we don't have to do a lot of hand-holding with them or, like, put up with childish behaviours, because we're all working in a professional environment. So, you know, it's a given that if you come here, you should be mature enough to be able to handle it. So I think we've done that to kind of kick off with, and now what we've started to do is sharing that wider to get feedback. And that is, I guess, the next important part is active listening. Right, so actually really listening to the people on the ground in terms of what their perceptions are and how they think, you know, they as a team want to operate and what they've observed, and feeding that back. And then I think at the end of that, you take a holistic look at all the feedback and the themes that have come out, and then maybe you can start to put together some statements around what your culture charter actually needs to look like. And that kind of, you know, it acts as a North Star for you as a team about how you want to operate. And I think without that, you know, you're going to get into situations where, you know, you don't actually know where the boundaries are. You know, we want people to be inclusive, you know, bring their best selves to work. And I think having a set of guiding principles makes people, you know, once people read them, it makes them believe that actually this is what my leadership team is saying, so therefore I can be open and I can have a voice. Otherwise you find people who will never have the courage to speak up, really. So I think the way that we've done it right now is one way of doing it. So we've talked about it, and now we're looking to get feedback on those themes from the actual teams that sit beneath it, and then we'll kind of formalize it. That works for us. I think other people approach it in different ways, which is you'll have your company values, and then you kind of feed from those top downs. And we're doing that. So we're looking at the top kind of organizational values about, you know, everyday health, for example. And we're trying to tie it back to the themes. But we talk a lot about drinking our own champagne or eating your own, you know, dog food, what you want to call it. But unless we live and breathe this, then our teams aren't going to believe it either. So that's how you create high-performing teams. And I know we've looked at other companies like, you know, the Netflixes of this world, who have their own culture deck, and, you know, it serves them well, you know, for example. And, you know, if we don't do it now, whilst we're in that kind of incubation stage of building our teams, it'll become too difficult to do it once we are triple, you know, or like quadruple in size.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, culture for me is it's everybody's responsibility, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we can talk about the values and the behaviours that we want to kind of stand by. But, you know, I've definitely seen instances where you might have, you're within a team, there's obviously individual team dynamics, and, you know, naturally, you know, some people get on better with other people than others,
yeah,
and
yeah,
those sorts of things. But, you know, I think, you know, it's about actually having the emotional intelligence and the awareness of the people around you, right? And saying, hey, you know what? If I was in that person's position, how would I feel right now and what's kind of going on? You're almost kind of, you're walking a day in another person's shoes to actually say, you know, kind of what's going on. And it's particularly important, you know, when you've got your cultural barriers, your cross-country. And you're, I think that's really kind of come home to me this week as we've been, you know, in India. You know, we've got people in India who are, you're coming from a very different cultural background. You're very different experiences, very different learnings from different companies, to what we have in the UK, for example. And, you know, it's very important, I think, to be very aware of those background differences and actually, you know, kind of meet people halfway.
Yeah.
And almost because we're remote and we're kind of operating via teams, you almost kind of need to make the effort to go and without work, on a personal level, just go and get to know the person. Go and actually put in time and be curious about, what that person's life's like, where they're coming from. And we need to find better ways to do that remotely than maybe we've done so far.
Yeah, and look, I think I always said that you can teach skills, right? So you can do an intense boot camp course and learn how to become a developer in 6 months. And we see lots of people changing careers as a result of that. And, it's great that the people are doing that. But changing someone's behaviours
is very difficult.
It's very, very difficult. So, if you've got some ingrained things that you can't get away from, then that's difficult. So, we're hiring great talent, but we've also got a strong focus on making sure that we're hiring people with the right behaviours and the right mindset as well, because otherwise we're going to create conflict within a team, which we don't want, really. So that's why having a culture charter, making that visible and letting people know how you want to operate as a team allows us to bring in the right talent that fit into our cultures and values.
Absolutely. And I mean, it's something from a personal point of view. I mean, so I'm quite open that I find navigating organizational politics quite difficult. That's definitely one of my, one of my areas for development. And I think that, what I've started to do is, I've started to think about, if I need to achieve a particular outcome, what are the different ways I might be able to approach doing that? And what might be the outcomes of my actions? So if I do this, what are the outcome going to be? If I do that, what's the likely outcome going to be? And actually almost kind of play through scenarios. And I think that's something that, for me, I think that's quite a healthy thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think that's something we need to encourage our teams to do also, to kind of think, particularly when you're talking to somebody in a different country or you're working with somebody that, maybe you don't know well, think about how they might take your message and what might be the consequence of you doing what you're about to do.
Yeah, and look, every company's got a level of, organisational politics where, people have strong views and, there's maybe a culture of fear as well in not having to be able to speak up or having the ability to speak up to kind of, say your own piece. But, I think for me, one of the things that you, especially in leadership positions that you need to recognize is active listening plays a huge part in success going forward, right? So even me coming from a technical background and working up the actual ranks to become a manager, then lead, etc., having the mindset to listen is I think where why I've got to where I've got to today, because without understanding people's pain points and perspectives and their views, you're not able to figure out how you can, meet them halfway to your kind of point, basically. So I think active listening plays a huge role in trying to get, that kind of sense of trust between two kind of individuals. And then using that trust to kind of influence, and I think influence is not in an aggressive way, but in a subtle way by using certain, certain words in terms of language, in terms of how you influence people, how you try to change people's perceptions to try and get outcomes that you want, or get outcomes that kind of serve both purposes, really, where you can meet in the middle. So, look, active listening is a huge part of, leadership. And I think, compromise, whether we like it or not, is a huge part of being successful as a leader. Sometimes you do things what you might not agree with it, but you have to do it for the benefit of the wider organization or the team that you're kind of working in. And just recognizing as well that, you have to be unified when you when you do those tough decisions, basically, that sometimes you're not going to get to a point where you're all aligned. But as long as there's commitment that, you know, it's the right thing to do, no matter how difficult it is, that's a sign of a true leader, to be fair. And I think that's where a lot of people kind of do fail, because it's all about me. It's all about me. And then, you know, they start to alienate people, you know, higher up, and it kind of acts as a bit of a ceiling for you to be able to progress. So, yeah, I mean, there's no right and wrong formula, but I think this is why it comes down to emotional intelligence, really, because, like, I won't mind sharing this, but, you know, in our leadership team this week, I said a common thread for all of the people that I've hired so far is not because of your technical ability. I think that's a given, right? So, you know, you can interview people and you can do tests to measure their technical maturity, but, you know, you've all got a very strong level of emotional intelligence and a deep connection with people. And we've seen that this week. I think if that's lacking, then that is a, you know, it's something that you can't really teach, I don't think. I think you either are naturally empathetic and you want to be able to help people, or you're the type of person who is very straight down the middle and is kind of outcome focused, really, and you struggle with having that other persona. It's like a learned behavior. It's not your natural thing to do. Whereas I think with me and obviously you, we care more about people. So it's a natural thing for us. And the things that we don't like doing, which is the politicsy kind of part, that's more of a learned behavior that we've had to kind of come across. But we know we need to do it, because without that, we can't be successful.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned there a little bit about your kind of how you got to where you got to in your career, right? Yeah. So, I mean, you're now your vice president of a multi-billion dollar your corporation.
Yeah.
Your Haley honors, you're a huge company. I mean, I guess, you know, not very many people, you know, achieve that, you know, that career level, you know, in reality. But I mean, from your point of view, you know, what is it that you need to be successful and to become a vice president in an organization like Haleon? You know, what do you need? What behaviors do you need? And how do you enable that to achieve outcomes?
So I think it kind of nicely follows on from the last point around, you know, most of the leaders within this organization and like other large enterprises that I kind of worked in, they have a high level of emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And it's a lot about, I guess I don't want to use the word, but it's servant leadership, really, yeah. Which is, you know, it's all about the people that work underneath you. And I think one of the things that I learned early on is when you move from technical roles into leadership and roles, you have this tendency to think that I'm going to do it all myself.
Mm.
And I think what you realize is that actually it's all about the people that are underneath you, and that's how you're successful if those people are successful. So I think recognizing that leadership is about the people that you serve is like the first kind of like mindset shift that you have to make to be able to start to become more of a, you know, a well-rounded like leader without having to do it all yourself. Basically, that's one thing that I think I learned quite early on. And I think the other thing is it's just being empathetic, really. You know, I think that's a very, very soft skill. Like, you know, communication style is very, very important as well. And it's not about what I've done or what, et cetera. Like, you know, people have short memories. You're only as good as your last like success, basically. And I think the ability to execute is another trait that is equally important as well. So, you know, if you're a person who can actually deliver, that kind of, you know, works in your favor as well, I think, as you get more and more senior. Then the final thing is building capability. And, you know, that can mean different things, but in my context, in this role, it was about building a brand new function from scratch, which is what we've done, right? We've hired lots of engineers. We've built a brand new software engineering function in, what, 6-7 months, basically. We've shipped out a product already, which is a fantastic achievement. I'm building my enterprise architecture practice from scratch as well. And that's what we class as like building capability. So somebody who understands how to build like high-performing teams, that is, you know, also a trait that is kind of looked at, really. People have got experience of doing that, knowing how to put the various pieces of the jigsaw together and then ultimately execute. Because once you've built your capability, then you have to deliver for the organization.
And I think that ability to execute changes over time as well. I mean, something that that I've observed, you know, in my own career is you kind of start out as an individual contributor.
Yeah.
And you're kind of on the ground. You might be coding as a developer or whatever it might be. And then you get to a point of seniority where you're probably not the individual contributor anymore. but you're having to get other people to do the work for you.
Right? Yeah.
So so you're now responsible for the work of many people. Right?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, and there's a step in your career when you kind of do that. And then you get to a certain point in your career where you step up and suddenly you're no longer an individual contributor and you're no longer the person that's actually responsible for the outcomes on the ground, but you're leading through others.
Yeah.
And you're having to get your other people to share your vision, because I can't be on the ground every day, in my team kind of doing the delivery. I need to be focused more on strategy in terms of where we're going. And then I guess you get to a point in your career where you move up again, and now you're leading through others who lead through others who then get the individual. So it becomes hierarchical in that sense. I mean, I guess we don't really like organization hierarchy. We like flatter structures, but there is a thing about how you motivate and inspire somebody who is an individual contributor on the ground when they perceive there is such a gap between that individual contributor on the ground and where you might be from a senior level. And I think that is, there are a lot of learnings in how to be successful at doing that, because it's not an easy skill to learn.
No, I think that's why that's an early point. We spent a lot of time in defining our culture because, my like leadership style, it isn't a hierarchical one. I think everyone knows that kind of works with me. There's a time when I have to put my badge on and, act as leader of, the area that I'm kind of like representing and make some tough decisions. But I also understand what my limitations are as well. I don't have all the answers, to be fair. I'm doing what you said is leading through others. So my job is to inspire you so you can inspire your engineering leaders, to inspire their teams, etc. So that's my job, to give you that motivation. I don't have all the answers. So I as part of building teams, to my other point, like when I've hired like this LT, I've looked at my own like gaps. And I've tried to figure out, well, what do I need to be able to be successful for the organization, really?
And that's that self-awareness thing again, right? Actually being aware of, you are not a fully formed, perfect individual.
No.
And I'm really sorry to tell you that, by the way, but you're not.
Yeah.
But actually understanding where your weaknesses are and then finding other people who can fill those gaps. In a really easy way. I mean, we go back to the Belbin team roles, you mentioned them before, and we've got such a good mix of skills across our leadership team. And we've been in India this week, and there's a guy called Shankar, who is one of our LT, and he is literally the most organized individual that I've ever met. and actually how we would have functioned this week if we hadn't had Shankar literally organizing us and made sure we were at the right time for the taxi, and the taxi turned up, and that we were at the right time for the planes or whatever else. It just wouldn't have happened. And you need people to do that. I'm not particularly organized. Yeah. You know what? Massively valued having that skill as part of the team.
Yeah.
So it's about understanding where your strengths are and what you bring to the party, and where there are gaps, making sure you've identified people you can bring in to fill those gaps.
Yeah, exactly. And that's been a part of my self-awareness, and never be never think you're a fully finished formed article, ever really. I'm always learning. I encourage people to learn all the time, speak to their peers in other industries. You're doing that through the podcast as well, and you're working with other people to try and understand how to approach certain things. It's just a continuous learning cycle. Like you are never the finished article, even if you get to CIO, like CTO level, really. You're always, there's always a learning or like a development need, really. That's just a way to approach your own self-development. Just, just keep on learning, keep on progressing, build teams, and in a way where you realize your own limitations and you understand what you need to be successful, and then work around that and evolve it over time.
Absolutely. So thinking about your IT and tech and obviously what we're doing in Haleon and in our organization, if you had to say maybe what the top two or three challenges you think most organizations have got over the next 6, 12, 18 months, what do you think those challenges might be?
So I think the first challenge probably is a pretty simple one, is we're moving out of the what was quite an intense pandemic period, and we're having to figure out how we best utilize the workforce we have in a remote first world now, which I think is kind of like normal. And how do we get that kind of closeness to our people? I think is a challenge for a lot of organizations, because we spend a lot of time on Teams and on like video calls, but we realized this week that's being here, there's a different dynamic being in person to being remote. So, and I think that's a real challenge for engineering leaders like the others, just in general, is like, you know, how do you get that cohesive unit working effectively when you're all in different parts of the world, you don't have that face time, you can't spend time on things like culture in a room and read people's faces and get to contribute in a whiteboard. So I think that's a challenge. And you know, how we work in a global organization where everyone's in different parts and different time zones, you know, when we're not in the office all the time, I think that's kind of like one big challenge that I see. It's not just for us, it's across the board, really. I think that the second challenge is around this kind of, do I transform or do I reduce complexity, basically? And I think a lot of organizations will get caught into that kind of difficult decision like balance, which is, if I invest, then I can't do X, but if I don't invest, then I can't get rid of Y, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a dilemma for everyone, really, because without investing, you're not building the capability that you need to get rid of, like, the other stuff, really. And I think there's a lot of cost challenges in general just out there because of, like, you know, how the pandemic has affected businesses, like, mm-hmm. globally. So that's one thing where I think there's going to be interesting things where people decide to build, or, you know, capability, or decide to just look at optimization. And that's the first thing. And then the third thing is talent, right? And I think we can't lose sight of that is, you know, for a long time, the actual power, as I call it, was with the companies from a hiring perspective. Mm. They could be quite prescriptive in what they were looking for, location, etc. Now, I think the tables have turned. I think they were turning anyway, but the tables are completely turned now, where actually the power is near the candidates, because they can now specify what they want, because they've spent 2 years doing something from home and they think they can do it. And actually, it's so aggressive out there in the market and so much competition that, you know, I think that is the other difficult thing about how companies not just bring in talent, but then how they retain that talent and how they make the work, in the, you know, interesting. And we've talked about a lot on this podcast around organizational politics, around culture, around development, around architecture. You know, if people don't see a cohesive, like, organization, like, you know, who's kind of in sync with all those things, they won't stick around.
Absolutely.
Basically.
I think I was talking to Mark Porter, who's the CTO of MongoDB, a few weeks ago, and he was saying that there's estimates that in the US alone, over the next 5 years, there's going to be 400,000 engineers short of what the market actually demands.
Yeah.
And I mean, that totally speaks to your point. I mean, it's so challenging to get the people with the right skill sets in the right place to do what you need to do. Which also speaks to everything we were talking around about, making sure within your organization you've got the right opportunities for development, to give engineers what they want and what they need in order to be successful and to grow as individuals and to work on the projects and the services that they really want to work with.
I think that's a realization that companies need to come to, is, like, there's so many startups that are happening globally right now, whether it be here in India, we've seen a lot of startups, you know, we've seen lots in the US and the UK. But anyone could write an app and put it in the App Store and start to monetize it. So, like, you're competing against that mindset, basically, where people don't need companies to be successful. They can be successful themselves, really. And if you bring people into an environment where it's toxic, there's lots of organizational politics, there's no real sense of what our culture is, that we want to work as, you know, as a team, those people won't stick around. Yeah. And I think, you know, that's why I put it into the kind of the top three bucket that you talked about, is, you know, that over the next few years, you know, that is going to be a challenge for everyone.
100% agree. Usman, it's been a pleasure to talk to you this morning. If people have been listening and you maybe want to reach out, or you've been interested in something you want to say and want to get in touch, what's the best way to contact you?
Yeah, just reach out to me on LinkedIn. You know, happy to have a chat with anyone, really. And if anyone wants to chew the fat on anything or get perspectives, or maybe point out some of the things that I might have said wrong, I'm completely fine with that as well. So yeah, just do reach out to me on LinkedIn. It's probably the best way to do it.
Brilliant. Well, Usman, it's been a real pleasure chatting to you here this morning. Thank you so much for taking the time out. It has been an incredibly busy week, actually, and finding time to do this has been a challenge, but it's been a real pleasure. Usman is just one of those people that really inspires you to want to do the best work you possibly can. I guess I've kind of got to say that because he is my boss, but there's a reason that I work for Haleon, and Usman ultimately is one of the key reasons I came to join the organisation. It was so insightful talking to him about some of his vision and some of his experience, particularly working in the enterprise architecture space, and a real pleasure to actually finally get him onto the podcast and to share some of his thoughts and ideas. If you've been enjoying listening to The Engineering Leader, please do reach out to me. You can find me at Steve Westgarth on Twitter, and also just search for Steve Westgarth on LinkedIn. I'm also really keen to hear from you about any topics you might want to hear on the podcast, things, maybe challenges in your own businesses that we can maybe help you with, or people that we can connect you to. And also, if you know of anybody who's got something interesting to say in the tech space, maybe wants to share some of their ideas or their own thinking, please do let me know, and we'll try to find an episode where they can come and talk about some of those things. In the meantime, remember, we all write bad code. If you disagree, you may as well switch off. My name's Steve Westgarth, and this is The Engineering Leader.